Welcome to another edition of Sports with Friends, episode 448. Two things happened to me this week. One, I realized the baseball season is creeping upon us. And two, 450 is kind of a milestone, don't you think? And it's funny the way plans go, because the week of the baseball season starting, I really wanted to have one of my old broadcast partners on. Just felt right. And then I found out from some PR friends of mine that we are going to have two more baseball guests the next couple of weeks. It's funny the way things go. I try to vary it up, and sometimes we go in spurts. Hey, in January, I think we did four football shows in a row. So that's the way it happens. I can tell you next week, former Major League player and manager Phil Nevin will join us. Most recently was the manager of the Angels. But that's next week. And then the week after, I cannot tell you who we have yet, but I can promise you, he is a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame. I'll leave it at that. Don't want to jinx anything. Yes, a Hall of Famer joins us for our big 450th episode. Jim Duquette, former general manager, was general manager of the Mets and Orioles, and then he got involved in broadcasting. He came over to MLB.com when I was still there. We did a show together on Sirius XM called Power Alley, and we've kept a friendship over the years. But one of the true great broadcast partners that I've been honored to have over the years, and it's crazy that we've gone 448 episodes and not had Jim on the show. But you know, now that the podcast has this many episodes, we say that a lot. It's ironic. Last week we had Ronnie Lane. Now we have Jim Duquette. We're just going down the Sirius XM roster. Duquette, in addition to the XM show, now works with Sportsnet New York, another one of my old employers, takes part in their Mets coverage. Little known fact about Jim Duquette, he called Johan Santana's no-hitter, the first ever no-hitter in Mets history, as a fill-in. He was filling in on a particular Friday. He also donated his kidney to his daughter and saved his daughter's life. That's the kind of guy Jim Duquette is, and he's one of my favorite human beings on the planet. Another one of my favorite people is Patrick Morrow, the head odds maker at BovadaSportsbook.com. It is still March, and it is still the NCAA tournament, the Sweet 16 round, and we will get your brackets up to speed with Patrick in just a moment. All right, so I've told you who we had on, but I couldn't list all the gigs. All I said was former executive. He's a television announcer, radio announcer, my former partner, longtime friend. There's more. So Jim Duquette, welcome to Sports with Friends. You want to spend half the podcast just listing everything you do?
I don't want to bore your listener, Seth. I think the main gig with Sirius XM and my pre and post work with SNY, that's enough. I mean, we can get in other things. And maybe over the course of our conversation, we'll get into some of those things. But yeah, I think that's probably plenty for now.
Well, you know, you've embraced it and you've excelled at it.
I appreciate it.
I think the first thing I wanted to ask you, when we were working together, I always thought it was temporary. I genuinely thought, and I might not have vocalized this to you, I always thought it was just going to be, there was going to be a phone call one day and said, Team X is calling. That's my true calling. Did that call never come, or is it that it just didn't fit your lifestyle?
I would agree. I always thought, and I still, it's now 15 years later, after I got into this full time, I still think that I'm year to year, and let's see what happens. So I always felt that way. And, you know, there had been phone calls along the way, but for whatever reason, it didn't work out. In fact, one of the times, actually, my cousin ended up getting a job with the Orioles. That job was open and they were having a hard time filling it. And I was still live locally in Baltimore, and I was going to put my name into that. And I think I would have had a good chance to do it at the time. My daughter was still dealing with her kidney ailment. It was before the transplant. And I remember being awakened in the middle. So I was thinking about the job, what I was going to say, how I was going to propose, sure. You know, kind of a come back to Peter Angelos and get involved, you know, with, as the GM again. The machine that she was hooked up to ended up going off, and this alarm went off in the middle of the night, and it was jarring and woke up the entire house. And, you know, everything was okay. There was an issue with the machine, but it was one of those jarring moments and a reminder of how serious her ailment was at the time, of being on at home dialysis. And so that was kind of the kick in the teeth that I needed at that time to remind yourself, hey, listen, we're not out of the woods with her health issue. It doesn't work for you at this time, you know, family wise. And so there were a series of moments, either the job offer wasn't right, or the person who asked, you know, didn't have a long-term gig that was, would make me comfortable enough to leave what I had already started. Or, you know, in this job, it's allowed me a lot of flexibility to do the 18,000 other jobs that I have that I equally enjoy. So, like, I think there's a lot of reasons why I haven't gotten into the front office. By the way, there's still a chance, whether it's at an ownership level or whatever, if the opportunity presents itself or if the right person came calling. But, you know, I've enjoyed this. It's been a fantastic career, and it's changed my life and my involvement with my kids, which is what I really appreciated, I think, the most.
Totally. Okay. Now there's three tangents. I should write these down. One answer. Ready? Three tangents. I'm going to put a pin. I do want to ask about your daughter.
Yes.
I mentioned it briefly in the open, but I didn't want to lead the, you don't lead a sports podcast with the story of her kidney and everything like that.
Right.
But you bring up the family aspect of it. And it's what, you know, my memories of baseball is just the everyday of it. And, you know, from an employment standpoint, it's a turn off, not a turn on. There's a great article this week. If you happen to be listening to this podcast the week that it's released, there was a great article Sunday in the Boston Globe. My buddy Chad Finn, who's been on this podcast before, said that the Red Sox have six guys splitting the analyst role on Nesson. It's like six guys. And it's not a knock on any one of the six guys, but have two. Like, have continuity. When a team can have that, it is such a benefit. But people are starting to get wise and see the lifestyles of it. And do you want to, after playing for 10, 12 years, now suddenly be in a world where you have to travel to 120, 130 games? Again, let me say that number again. 120, 130 games. It's too much.
It's too many games. And I think you hit on it. And that's why, you know, as the players, today's player, they make a lot more money than they used to. It's why you're seeing guys not get into the coaching ranks, and why, as a sport, Major League Baseball, it's hard to find managerial candidates, because some of the really good ones have made a lot of money, and the sacrifice to be a coach or to start, let's say, in the minor leagues or start as a bench coach where you don't get paid a lot of money. Even the pay for managers has come way back and scaled way back from where it was maybe even 5-10 years ago. It's hard to retain good candidates if the front offices are going to look at this as, well, you're a replaceable part, you're interchangeable, you know, because we're going to feed you information and all we need you to do is build out the lineup the way we suggest. Those managers, who wants to be in that position to feel like you're a puppet of the front office? There has to be, I've always felt there has to be a separation, like church and state, like general managers and managers. There are two different methods and ways of building a team and trying to win. A GM has the long-term viewpoint, mindset, and the manager is like, win today. And those are completely separate. They are conflicting in some ways. And that's why the good GM manager candidates, when they work together like that, that's why you see the Atlanta Braves and the Los Angeles Dodgers and things like that, because they understand that one is different than the other and they make it work together. And, you know, that's why Pat Gillick was so darn good at his job and why I tried to emulate him as general manager, because his communication skills were so exceptional.
Okay, but now, you know, tangent number four, you bring up managers, and I would argue, you know, you referenced L.A., Dave Roberts, Snitker in Atlanta, Aaron Boone, I'll use him as an example.
Yeah.
These guys are younger. They're younger than when I remember covering the sport on an everyday basis. And what they are they are able to talk to Gen Z, the current generation of players. The reason why I say that is these guys are doing everything the front office executes. And 9 times out of 10, when I see social media after a baseball game, the only people that bitch about managers are doing so because they are 45 plus and they think of baseball like it's 1984. When Aaron Boone's not losing that job, no matter if the Yankees lose 10 in a row, Aaron Boone's not losing that job. I'm just using him as the example. I'm not picking on him.
Yeah.
Because he's doing everything they ask. There's no managers being fired anymore mid-season because there's no conflicts. These managers they sit in their offices, they get the rules of the game. You know, this guy's going to throw 65 pitches. You're bringing in this dude in this scenario. If you're up 2 runs, you bring in this guy. Everything is scripted. And so these managers, you say, well, why are today's players? It's not just that they made a lot of money. They're seeing the puppets that these managers are.
Right.
And they're going, why would I want that for my life?
Right. Yeah.
Tell me I'm wrong.
No, I think there is a big element of truth to that. I think you're not getting the job if you're not going to be more aligned with the general manager right from the start. So the job is blurred a little bit in that sense, because it's how you interact with the general manager, how you incorporate the information that they are bringing in. So they're the ones who control the job and the hiring process, and you're going to be more aligned with them than not. Are you going to have, you know, you do have the disagreements that we're not aware of, but they are using the information that's brought down from the front office way more than they ever have, because the information is pretty good. I mean, it's
a lot more data than the announcers are saying on the broadcast.
Way more data. I mean, and it's a lot of it is accurate. Simplistically, like the data when it comes to those high speed cameras that you can get to help use as a teaching tool to speed up the development of a certain type of breaking ball for today's pitchers. You can change a slider or a curveball grip in one bullpen session, all of a sudden you have a nasty pitch that you can use in the game. The next start, it would take you a full year, prior years without that data, to first off convince a guy that he could use another pitch, and second of all, that it would be effective enough and he'd have the confidence to throw it in the game. You had to wait months. And then sometimes, you know, when they would throw it and they didn't have success, they'd scrap it and you have to go back and forth. Now you can convince them, you know, overnight. And so the amount of data that they have, it's so much more. The front offices are so much bigger, but it's way more accurate than just the eyeball test and what you used to have. So, yeah, still the best front offices and managers incorporate both, but the data is much more powerful and I would say less subjective than it used to be 10 years ago or even 15 years ago.
More of this conversation with Jim Duquette in just a moment, but it is March Madness. The Sweet 16 is this weekend, so let's break down the brackets and the latest odds on all the games in the Sweet 16 with the head odds maker at Bovada, Patrick Morrow. We'll start off in the South region, where Marquette, the number 2 seed, will play the 11 seed NC State. Also, the number 1 seed, Houston, takes on number 4, Duke.
That's right, Seth. In a tournament with not too many Cinderellas, as we noted, NC State is that rare double-digit seed that has made it to the Sweet 16. And, we've seen this in previous years where a team that runs hot, even if they weren't really good before the tournament or not perceived to be good, they continue to get that kind of betting action. And that is what we've seen with NC State. They are currently +230 underdogs, 6.5 point underdogs on the point spread. And about 70% of all money is coming in on NC State so far. Looking at the other East game, Houston versus Duke. This is a traditional 1-4, and you're looking at a much tighter point spread here. Houston is currently a 4-point favorite, and the over-under is much lower. It's sitting at 134. Quick scroll suggests that is the lowest total of all Sweet 16 games. In terms of where the action is, it's pretty split so far with about 50-50 money on Houston and Duke right now at Bovada.
Let's take a look at the Midwest region. The top seed, Purdue, takes on number 5, Gonzaga. The other matchup is really chalk. It's number 2, Tennessee, and number 3, Creighton.
A couple great games here, Seth. Right out of the gate, you have Purdue, a 1 seed that has looked strong all year. I think a lot of America has become familiar with Zach Edey over the weekend and seeing just him dominate down low as he can. Looking at the point spread, Purdue is currently a 5.5-point favorite, getting a little bit more money on them on the spread. However, Gonzaga is getting a lot of love on the money line so far, especially after knocking off Kansas the way they did on Sunday. Over-under for this one is sitting at 154. That is the highest of the second highest of the Sweet 16 games, pardon me. Looking at the other game in the region, we have Creighton, Tennessee, as you noted, and that's a pretty tight one there as well. A really, really tight one, pardon me, as the spread is sitting at 3 right now. And we're seeing, again, a 50-50 split in terms of handle on Creighton and Tennessee. The over-under is sitting at 143.5 right now at the bottom.
All right, let's go to the East region, TD Garden in Boston. Number 1, UConn. That's kind of a home game for them. They take on San Diego State in a rematch of last year's NCAA title game. Also chalk in the other matchup, Iowa State and Illinois, the 2-3.
That's right, Seth. Connecticut coming into this one as the biggest favorite in the Sweet 16. They are 11-point favorites over San Diego State right now. And looking at the position, a lot of love on the Huskies. We're seeing about 80% of all bets on them to cover that very big number. The over-under is currently set to 136 right now. The action's a little bit more balanced there. Looking at the second game in that region, we have what is currently the tightest point spread of the Sweet 16 games, as Iowa State is currently a 2-point favorite over Illinois. Illinois had a really good start to this tournament, has looked very, very strong relative to their seed, and they're getting a lot of love on both the money line and the point spread, as we're seeing about 70% of all bets on the Illini in this one. The over-under is currently sitting at 146.5, and curiously here, this is the only game so far that we have a position on the under in this one. So bettors are expecting defense again on that 146.5 at Bovada.
And then there's the West region. Number 1 seed is North Carolina against number 4 Alabama. And then a 2-6 matchup with Arizona against number 6 Clemson.
Yeah, interesting ones here, Seth. North Carolina, the 1 seed in the West. They're currently 4-point favorites over Alabama, which is pretty tight. And this also kind of reinforces that the odds makers are not as big on the Tar Heels as their seed would suggest. You know, Arizona in this region, despite being a 2, they were the only team, we talked about it last week, but they were the only number 2 seed that was actually the favorite to win their region in the West. So having said all of that, North Carolina, perhaps because of how low that spread is relative to their ranking, they are the most bet team so far in all Sweet 16 matchups, with about 90% of all money on the Tar Heels, both at the minus 180 money line and minus 4 on the point spread. North Carolina, Alabama, if you like points, Seth, 173.5 is the over-under for this one. Looking at Arizona, Clemson quickly. Clemson, nice win over Baylor, but we still don't like them that much in our power numbers. We have Arizona, it's currently a 7-point favorites right now at Bovada, with the action being split 50-50.
That is Patrick Morrow. Enjoy the basketball this weekend. The Sweet 16, always a great time. Now back to our baseball conversation with my old pal, Jim Duquette. Do you sense that the Bud Blacks of the league are just continuing to be a dying breed? I appreciate that Dusty Baker wanted to come back and kind of have one last send-off, but these guys don't relate to today's players the way they used to. And it just seems to me like the whole manager's role, you know, replay has changed that too. You know, it just mm-hmm. used to have the personality. You know, I remember growing up, Sparky Anderson would run out, you know, Billy Martin and you know, these guys.
Pinella.
Lou, Pinella. Yeah, look at that. Our brains are in sync. You know, just the idea of that. And, you know, I remember going in, I've told this on our radio show a long time. I remember one time Lou Pinella was managing and he took his starter out, this guy, Jeff Fassero, and he took the starter out and the bullpen blew the game. And we went into Lou's office and said, how come you took Fassero out? And he says, well, me and Stan Williams got in a mean game of rock, paper, scissors, and his paper covered my rock. And like, now they can't do that. They can't ask that question. One of the things that Ronnie Lane last week said on the show last week was what he loved was going to a ballpark and hearing how many executives listened to SiriusXM, because you travel so much and SiriusXM, you listen in Denver and Dallas and, you know, Wyoming and wherever you were, you could listen to it together. We also, you and I, infamously, I think, had a pretty good rapport with players.
Yeah.
Remember Kevin Millar was called in because he loved that I had a Palm Pre and not the iPhone. I struggle with this when I talk to young people because, you know, my favorite things about relationships with players, when I was in my 20s and I was with the Rockies and the Mariners, I earned their trust. And so I was exposed to things that normal reporters maybe wouldn't have gotten. And I think that my comfortability grew as I was getting more access. Now we live in this day and age where everything is camera phones and clickbait and try to scoop the guy next to you. If I'm a player, I am so standoffish to the media. I can't imagine having the relationship. So now you're doing similar jobs to what you did when you and I worked together.
Yep.
Are players more reticent to the media? Are you noticing that? Is it transparent or is it obvious?
No, I think it's obvious. I think more the younger players are more prepared to answer questions. It's more canned answers. I think that there's that, you know, they handle the questions way better than the younger guys did, you know, 15 years ago, let's say. But they're also, you're not getting a lot of new information. It's rare. And also I think that some of the stuff that you were talking about, there's a distrust that has grown over time. And there are ways where the same players or older players, they have avenues to get their points across, whether it's their own podcast or some of these other podcasts, or they can, you know, there's enough people involved, different people involved in the media now where they do have found a couple of people that they do trust and they're willing to say things, you know, on their podcast. So there's ways to have your word, you know, heard, get your information out that you want. You know, in other avenues that what didn't exist in the past. So I think that there's probably a combination of factors that, you know, that have kind of brought us to this point. The younger player in particular, I think, understands, you know, the back and forth. There's the part that, you know, it's the part of your job. Some of them still understand that aspect. They understand that better now because teams are doing a better job of preparing them. They also know they're not
that
they don't stepping on any landmine.
I don't mean to cut you off, but is that post COVID?
COVID had something to do with it. Yeah. COVID certainly had something to do with it. I'll say this, the access. So as a sport, we figured out how that we could communicate with them over, you know, Zoom or other platforms like this. And you to do your job, you didn't need the hours of access that, you know, you'd be standing around in the clubhouse going, what are you standing around for? You know, players would all say that. What are you standing around for? Well, in case something happens. The writers didn't want to be in there for those 3-hour periods or 2.5-hour periods, but they were afraid their competition would get something that they wouldn't. So now, you know, that access has been limited. You know, there's not as much time before, after. Teams have done a better job of, you know, limiting the clubhouse access after batting practice, as an example, prior to the game, giving the players a little bit more space. And I don't think we've been hurt, you know, information wise because of that. I just think that's a natural kind of development. It's evolved over time that, you know, through COVID, you know, both good and bad, but I think more good. We didn't need to be in the clubhouse all that long, sitting there, basically standing there talking to each other rather than talking to players, you know.
It was a weird dynamic. And just for the audience's perspective, this is not just a baseball thing. We're talking to a baseball guy here. This is all sports. You know, all sports are dealing with this wall that players put up.
Right.
And I just think, you know, I've told the story 300 times on this podcast, but when I got my first gig out of college, I was covering the Denver Broncos, and I think I went 6 weeks before I asked a question. I was scared out of my mind. I was 23, and I overheard players. I've talked about this countless times. I overheard players talking about Madden football. And I played Madden football, and I meekly went over, "Are you guys talking about the video game?" And they're like, "Yeah, you play the video game?" And we, you know, developed relationships based on our mutual love of a video game. Like, right. That's how it happened. And all I'm thinking to myself is, if that's 2024, there is no way a player is admitting that they play on, because if they are, they're on Twitch. And you already know. And what everybody's afraid of is the clicks and the clicks and the clicks and the clicks. And it's just such an awkward, uncomfortable feeling that I would imagine most players are just drilled. You know, you remember you and I used to go to that rookie career development program in Virginia, and players were trained on how to deal with the media. That was what I was doing there. I was doing practice interviews with all these guys. And, you know, I remember, you know, Josh Beckett and Brad Penny, and I'm just names, Randy Wolf, just thinking of names off the top of my head of guys that I developed friendships with from that experience. And nowadays, I can't imagine, I don't know anybody that knows Aaron Judge. I don't know Aaron Judge. And Aaron Judge, unlike Derek Jeter, now granted, I'm disconnected from the sport much more than I ever was, and that's my personal choice. But I can't imagine. I have no idea who he is, anything about him. I don't know what his personality is like. All I know is he gets hurt a lot. That's and he had this monster year. Like, that's what I know about this guy. And I don't know. I just, it's a weird dynamic that has embraced in a time when the sport, I'm kind of segueing into one of the things I wanted to address with you. This sport skews older. More than any other sport. You know, hockey doesn't have a fraction of baseball's audience, but they skew young. The NBA is the king of social media, and the NFL is the king of all media. Where does baseball fit into all that? And, you know, like FM radio and cable television, I'm not sitting here being a doomsdayer and saying it's all dying, but the analogy that I've made, and I'll give you the floor, you know, I just turned 50. When I'm 80, the people who are 20 now will not have grown up with the passion that I grew up with having for that sport. And it's more apathetic. So that when that 20-year-old is then 50, they are not going to give a crap about that sport. Is that something that you've thought of? Is that something that, is this sport just finite? Is it just, this is the fan base, and you know what? Quit putting the games on all these apps because the 65-year-old's getting annoyed. Is that what we're doing here?
Well, I think that, you know, to your point with major, we'll stick to Major League Baseball. They, I think, understand now as the average age has gotten older and older, and they send out these surveys to, you know, to their fan base, and they realize one way to get younger is to try to encourage more involvement. the numbers of participation at the youngest levels now, T-ball, Little League, is on the rise again. Now, for a long time, the sport ignored that. And because of that, I think, you know, if you're the thought process, and I don't think it's wrong, the more you participate, the more likely you're to now then engage in the sport and watch it a little bit more. And by watching it more, you're hopeful that you're going to, you know, hook the fans. And I think because so they start with the participation, then they look at the product and they're getting feedback that the product was taking too long, you know, it crept up over 3 hours in terms of the length of the game. And like, well, we better do something dramatic about that too. And so now the pitch clock, you know, gets basically instituted without much, approval from the players, but that's at least in, you know, year one, changed the perception a little bit that, okay, these games are going on and on and on, dragging on forever. They shave 30 minutes off the game time itself. And, you know, while the jury's still out on how that's going to be impacted for this year, the pace of the game is better. I think it encourages, I'll take a small example. If you're a family of, three young kids and your mom and dad, they're bringing the kids to the ballpark during the summer on a Tuesday or Wednesday night. Let's say they decide to go Tuesday night and their school's in session the next day. The game starts at 7. You can actually see most of the game by 9 o'clock and get home and still be reasonable, or watch it on television and watch most of the game, if not the entire game, and be able to get to bed at a decent hour. That to me is a big change and difference that Major League Baseball's finally embraced. And I'm hopeful that, you know, 20 years from now, like you're talking about, or 25 years from now, let's just say less than that, 5 years from now, we've seen a significant growth in that area where we start to see, you know, the younger audiences watching the game, not only on TV, but in person, because the attendance is taking a hit too. A lot of that was COVID related, but it hasn't rebounded nearly as much, even though Major League Baseball has told us 26 teams had an increase in attendance, you know, last year. That's, you know, the bar was pretty low coming out of COVID.
Well, one of the fun things I used to do with you, I always tried to make you think. That was my goal. I was just trying to push you in direction. I loved doing it because you have such a great analytic mind. And let me throw one at you.
Yeah.
The current state of bullpens, where everyone throws 100. This was brought to my attention. Derek Lowe was on the podcast last year and said that today he wouldn't get signed. That's crazy because he had a great career.
Yeah.
The reason why I say that is, you know, these guys, each guy comes in throwing 98 to 101, and it's fire, 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 fire. But my point is, and I just want credit on this podcast that I haven't brought up launch angle yet. I just, because that's the bane of my existence.
Yes.
But the bullpen thing, the percentage of games that are actually come from behind, that the team that's losing comes from behind, is like less than 20%. So if you're watching a game and it's the Braves and the Brewers, I'm just throwing two teams out, and Atlanta's up 5-2, there's a pretty good chance the Brewers are not coming back.
Right.
Now, take that logic and say the guy who works 9 to 5, right? He's the banker, the construction worker, whatever he is. And given his family commitments, he has young kids, or he has a poker game, or whatever his life is like, he can only dedicate a half hour to sports a night. If I said that to said person, and I said, what part of the NBA game would you want to watch? He'd say the last 30 minutes. Hockey? Oh, the third period.
Mm-hmm.
Football, the fourth quarter. But in baseball, it'd be the first half hour because of the numbers that I gave you before.
Right.
This is what I've been thinking about. This is like one of the main things I wanted to ask you about. You could talk about pace of play and time of game because those are two different things. Sometimes the pace still sucks, even if it's faster.
Right.
But that's not the issue. My issue is the end of games sucks. The ends of games, like I'll put a game on. Like I changed in 2022. I didn't watch a game. Like I didn't watch a game. It was unwatchable. Last year, I watched it enough that I would put on usually the Mariners, the Red Sox, or the Yankees, because I do, you know, cover them for iHeart. And if they play a day game, I'll have it on here in my office. And I'm just noticing that these teams never come from behind. And my argument to this is analytics have to show that if the game is over by the sixth inning, their drama is the thing that baseball does better than anybody. Mm-hmm. And they're dropping the ball on that. So it's a loaded question. I understand that. And I threw a lot of facts at you. But my question to you is, how do we make ends of games better?
Well, I don't know if – I mean, there's a lot of different rule changes that you could try to come up with. All of them are hypothetical, none of which will end up ever happening. So
limiting pitching changes.
Limiting pitch changes.
Pitcher changes.
Being allowed to manipulate your lineup so the best players get it at bats in the final inning, things like that that you say, okay, well, you know, Mike Trout in his prime only gets 5 at bats a night, and he may not even face the relief pitcher in the 8th or the 9th inning because of the way the lineup flipped around. He ends up hitting in the 7th inning. You never saw him again, so the chances of winning are coming from behind, you know, without him getting in a bat are slim and none. And, you know, and so, you know, dictating that is hard. The other thing that teams have done a better job of is not necessarily going with their closer to pitch the 9th. They're bringing them in the key situations.
Yeah.
Which is smart baseball.
No, none of it's not the smart strategy. If I care about a team, care about the health of a sport, that's different.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that the, you know, whether you need to see, you know, the team come from behind for you to watch the game or not. You know, I don't think that baseball is one of those that you're watching for 30 minutes. You're either watching it for a longer period of time or you're not watching it at all. And you've been around baseball for a long time. It's completely comparing it to the other sports is always been an apples and oranges comparison. It just has. The action is completely different. You can't put the ball in your best player's hands and take your chance. You can in the NFL, you can in the NBA,
right,
and you definitely can in the NHL. So any comparisons to any other sports for me is not only is it not a fair comparison, I don't even think it's relevant. It's not relevant.
No,
that
but you've
sense.
Seen a fourth quarter of a football game. You've seen goal line stand.
Yeah.
You've seen the third period of a hockey game when they pull the goalie and they're trying everything. Like you've seen in basketball, which has its own flaws, you know, there's too much reliance on the three, but even still the last 2 minutes of a basketball game are the best part.
Right. Yeah. I'm not a big NBA fan because of the, you know, they've introduced the analytics to an extreme where you're like, okay, well, the 3-pointer makes more sense. Well, you know, and I'm amazed at how good the shooting is in the NBA and how far, you know, I mean, there doesn't seem to be a limit on how far away they are from the basket, and their you know, accuracy is unbelievable, but I don't find that entertaining at all. You know, so like that's the aspect of it, you know, that, you know, in the NFL, I mean, you know, nothing's going to trump their entertainment value. Right. So like, comparing the NFL to anything is probably not a fair comparison. So, you know, I think each of the other sports has their flaws. I think for me, number one thing that baseball had to fix was how long and boring the games were. It still might be a boring game, let's say, in somebody's mind that there wasn't enough offense. I'm still a purist, so I'm not like you're really not convincing me one way or the other. Like I love the sport. I always will, no matter the form of it. And I make adjustments like some people do to the new, like I like this brand of baseball as much as I did 20 years ago. because I've adapted to it, right? I was a National League guy. Never thought I'd ever say I like the DH in both leagues, but now I've gone accustomed to it and I like it. So, you know, but I think the number one thing they had to address, and they have, is this pace. There's pace. You know, very little action. And so from there, I have a high degree, and I think it's been a success. So I have a high degree of faith that whatever is next, we'll figure out as a sport how to address it. What that maybe it is what I can propose. Maybe they'll give you that in the ninth inning. You can put your best three hitters up there. And by the way, that'd be some kind of fun debate, because if let's say Mike Trout's example is he went 0-for-4 with 3 punch outs, and now it's the ninth inning. Do you still want him hitting in the ninth if he's had that type of night, or do you want to go with the guy who maybe had 3 hits? It wasn't like that debate would be really fun.
Shootout. I don't know if Connor McDavid taking.
Right. I don't know if we'll ever get there, but that would be kind of fun too. And I think that, you know, it's something that Major League Baseball at least has an open mind to. But we're probably talking 10 years from now.
What do you make of these studies that are saying that pitchers are getting hurt because of the pitch clocks? That the pitch clocks are actually hurting pitchers. Is there any credence to it, or is it just crying and whining?
I mean, we have 1 year of data, you know, you and I were talking about the injuries for pitchers when we were together 15 years ago, you know, like the sport has never been able to figure out the injury problems for pitchers. And, you know, they do think about the recovery time in between pitches and they point to that, but you know, I think that there are some points where they're basically throwing all out max effort. That is clearly a huge stress on your arm. And then the change of pitches that you see, like the big sweeping slider, which, by the way, it's a slider. You can call it a sweeper. It's a slider. It has the principles of a slider. It's just a big breaking slider.
Thrown the same way.
Thrown the same exact freaking way. It's just, okay, we're, you know, some of those things, you know, the split finger is back in vogue now. Guess what? That always had a stress on your arm. You can sit there and say it's not stressful on your arm. It is. You're throwing. So,
it has to be.
So we haven't found a solution on that. I think the max effort that we ask of our pitchers now is the biggest single cause for why we're having so many injuries, not the pitch clock or anything else.
To that end, though, you know, you mentioned that one of my favorite stories, and you know, I if I've said it on the podcast 35 times, I said it on the radio show with Jim dozens of times. The great Billy Sample,
yes,
the great Billy Sample, who's been on this podcast, who's screaming about a tree, or so he's yelling about something these days. Billy tells this tremendous story about the 1970s Texas Rangers. And the Texas Rangers, there was a rule that if you struck out, you were not allowed to utilize the services of the bat boy, that you had to carry your own bat back to the dugout. You were not allowed to use the bat boy in shame,
right,
for striking out. Now, with, you know, everybody knowing everybody's pitch counts, if a guy gets a 9 pitch at bat, even if the 9th pitch is a swinging strike 3, that's considered in analytics world a productive strikeout.
Right.
My reaction when I heard that, I was like, F you. Like, no. I'm sorry. There's no such thing as a productive strikeout. That's garbage. And what had bothered me a lot, this is in 2021, leading into 2022. I'm on record. 2022, I saw 2 games, and they were both postseason games that I had to cover for iHeart.
Right.
2021, there were like 6 no-hitters. And so you'd see on social media, you get the alerts, 6th inning, hey, Johnson has a no-hitter. Okay, great. And you put it on, and these hitters aren't trying to get on base. Their approach to their at bats is how they've been taught. And the fact that they are being no hit doesn't mean one little iota to these people. And they don't care. And my argument has always been that if you think about great almost no-hitters, that almost happened, where the hitter was doing everything in his power just to stay alive, to get a ball in play, to get a hit, that no-hitters of the past were better.
Mm-hmm.
Even the Mike Mussina, the Sunday night one at Fenway Park, where he didn't get a no-hitter, that's a masterful pitcher performance than any of Clayton Kershaw's strikeouts. It's harder to do it then. And now when I see strikeout records or huge strikeout numbers, that's flailing, my man. That's yeah. What that is. And this is what I will admit. Maybe I got too close and I saw the way the sauce is made, but I see that. And as a fan, I'm insulted. I'm like, these guys are not even trying to get on base. There being no hit, that's a big deal.
Right.
They should not be allowed to utilize the services of the bat boy.
I think that's a valid punishment. I would like to take that a little further and maybe not allow their uniform to be washed by the clubby either. By the way, with all these, one aside, I was in the spring training, and the one thing that they, you know, with all these expanding staffs that you have, like, you know, 12 coaches at the major league level, analytics everywhere and offices, you know, the one group of people that haven't expanded, the clubhouse guys. They have the same staff. They're washing forever. I don't know how they get any time off, these guys, these poor guys.
And with these uniforms, they're probably shrinking.
They have less to wash, that's for sure. And they're see-through, so they dry quicker. Yeah. So these are all the things we used to talk about. I forget what your – oh, the strikeout. So the strikeout. So here's the interesting thing.
Well, you made a comment. You said you embrace this level of baseball just as much as you did 20 years ago. And I see strikeouts, and I would say the Jim Duquette that I remember must hate the flailing.
Yes.
Even trying to make contact.
Yeah, I do. I do. There was – so I was also a hater of the overshift, the gross overshift. If I was a hitter trying to hit 97, 98, 99 miles an hour, and I had to also, I put a graded bat together and I hit the ball the other way and went right to the friggin' guy that was, you know, shifted, or I pulled the ball and I made contact, but I had three guys on that side of the infield, I would be frustrated too. The old Mark Teixeira effect, right? Mark Teixeira got paid all that money, and then all of a sudden, the overshift, he pulled everything into the shift. So he said, you know what? I'm going to try to hit it over the shift by changing my bat path, and I'm going to try to hit a home run every at bat. That was terrible for the game. So we got rid of the overshifting, thankfully. We'll see if it comes back into vogue about putting the ball in play. Some teams, like the Mariners this past year, spent an entire winter going from a high strikeout offense to one that puts the ball in play more and it has, you know, better ABs all the way around. And I think when you see the teams, I'll go back to the Astros, let's take out the year that they were using a trash can to make better contact. They did build teams that tried to make better contact when they didn't know the pitch was coming. And so I think, you know, when you see teams that win, we're a copycat league. When you see teams where they have offenses like that, that try to put the ball in play, there's been a better effort, and there's better preparation of trying.
But
I'm gonna
push back. A lot of people thought that would happen in 2015 when the Royals won, and never happened.
Which part?
People didn't embrace putting the ball into play. They went back to the well with these analytics the feast or famine. Everybody's trying to be Jay Buhner and Steve Balboni.
When you look at the teams, the offensive teams that make it to the postseason, more times than not, of the eight teams now that get in, more times than not, the top six or so are teams that put the ball in play better than the others. It may not be at the rate that we all remember, which would be, which would be league average, but they are putting it together, putting the ball in play a little bit better. And I think that they are getting better. Today's hitter is actually adjusted better to the 96, 97 miles an hour and trying to hit it than they ever have. It's still not perfect, but it's not as big of a deal when I'm going around spring training this year and talking to hitters in particular, like, you know, you're seeing better at bats, whether it's going to translate into more offense or putting the ball in play more, we'll wait and see. But because pitchers always adjust, right? So you're like, man, you could never pitch up in a strike zone and get away with it. Teams, you know, the hitters would make you pay. Now pitchers are able to throw up in the strike zone because of that launch angle that we waited for 40 minutes before we used the term in this podcast. So now you're going to see hitters have to adjust, or else they're going to get eaten up by that pitch up, you know, basically belt high or a little bit above belt high. So again, the adjustments for me in watching that and then seeing it kind of slowly evolve in the sport is always fascinating for me.
And I've said this to you many times, so that I'm just saying this on this podcast just for the record, so it'll be saved in posterity forever. Everyone praised you when you offered to give one of your kidneys to your daughter.
Yes.
And what I said to you is, you are the model of what I want to be as a father. I wanted, God forbid, I don't want to have to give my kidney to my kids, but I want to be that guy. I want to be that person. And I'd like to think that anybody I know would do the same thing in the same position. You just happen to had to do it. So I say that in context. How many years ago was that? And how are you physically? Is there any issue with you physically because you have one kidney? And how is your daughter?
So thank you for
30
that.
Now?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, she's graduating from college in 2 months. It's amazing, right? So it'll be 12 years in June. It's the same. It was 4 days apart from Johan Santana's no hitter for the Mets,
yep.
Which I called. I was in that booth, yep, with Howie Rose just by complete accident. And then literally three, I guess it was 3 days later, I was giving my kidney, yep, to Lindsay. I have no health issues at all. And so I obviously I'm an advocate of organ donation. I never thought I would be alive to see the impact that donating any type of organ would have on an individual, but she's living proof that, you know, that it of the impact of it. And I will say this, you would, if you saw the suffering that my daughter went through, sure, for 7.5 years, you would do the same thing. Any dad or mom would do it if they had the ability to help change their life. To me, it's more about the education aspect of it. And knowing that if you do, if you are a donor, it doesn't adversely affect your life. You have to go through an extensive amount of testing before they are willing to put you under the knife. Anyway, so the moral of that is, if you're in good shape, you go through the testing and you are able to donate, it will change, you know, it will change lives. And I've had this conversation with a lot of people, but the Eckstein family was instrumental in me learning about the effect after the effect, because they've had all sorts of kidney ailments too. And I talked to one of them, David's brother, whose name is escaping me at the moment, but I talked to him extensively about what he did ahead of and after the surgery to get through it. And so I share that information to others if they're ever in that position, to, like you said, God forbid you don't want to be in that spot, but if you ever are, I would encourage anyone to do it. So thanks for letting me talk about it.
I'm happy to do it. And all I can say is, throughout my time covering baseball, you have been there. Love doing shows with you. It has been a focal point of my career. And it's a thrill to have you on Sports with Friends.
I appreciate that. I'll leave you with this. If you're going to watch a young team, a young talent, the Baltimore Orioles, my, yeah, former team, is the team to keep an eye on this year. So not only because they sent Jackson Holliday to the minor leagues, and you and I would have a whole show on major league rule manipulation, service time manipulation. We're still talking about it. But outside of that, he'll be up at the big league level soon. And when he is, it's coming. He'll be fun to watch, but that team will be fun to watch too.
Oh man, stay in touch, stay healthy. Right. I'll talk to you soon.
All-star break.
All right. I booked a podcast in July. Actually, booking guys like Jim Duquette is easy. We're going to do a couple of baseball podcasts in a row to commemorate the 2024 season. Former Major League manager Phil Nevin is going to join us. And for episode 450, we have an actual Hall of Famer. I don't want to jinx it yet, but we have an actual Hall of Famer joining us on the show. So a couple of baseball episodes for the next couple of weeks here on Sports with Friends. We'll see you then.
If you want me to stay, I'll be around today to be available for you to see. I'm about to go, and then you'll know for me to stay, I got to be me. You'll never be in doubt, that's what it's all about. You can't take me for granted and smile. Come on, please, I'm gone, forget reaching me by phone, because I promise I'll be gone for a while. When you see that you have been the kind of person that you really are now. We got to get in straight. How could I ever be late when you're my woman? Take